Chapter 19. The giant tree trunks soared like columns in an ancient temple. Their intertwining branches blocked the sun's rays and created an artificial twilight on the forest floor. Far below the treetops, the dented old pickup lurched and dipped like a boat in a storm as it climbed over ropey tree roots and unyielding rocks. Joshua Green sat on the passenger side, jouncing on the hard seat. He kept one hand above his head to cushion the impact of his skull against the interior of the truck's roof. Green was an environmental law expert with Sentinels of the Sea. He was a sandy-haired, thin-faced man whose large round glasses and bird-like nose made him look like an emaciated owl. He had gamely toughed out the ride without a complaint until the truck hit a bump that practically bounced him through the overhead. "I'm feeling like a kernel in a popcorn machine," he said to the driver. "How much longer do I have to endure this torture?" "About 5 minutes. Then we'll start walking," Ben Nighthawk replied. "Don't blame me for getting sick of the bumpy ride. Sorry about the transportation, too. It's the best my cousin could come up with." Green nodded in resignation and turned his attention back to the deep woods that encroached on every side. Before being assigned to SOS headquarters, he'd been part of the field operations SWAT team. He had been rammed and shot at, and he'd spent short but unforgettable times in jails no better than medieval dungeons. He had acquired a reputation for amazing aplomb under fire, and his professional appearance disguised a tough interior. But the unnatural darkness of his surroundings unnerved Green more than anything or anybody he had ever encountered at sea. "The road doesn't bother me. It's these damned woods," he said, staring out at the forest. "Damn creepy. It's the middle of the day, the sun is shining, and it's dark as Hades out there. Like something out of a Tolkien novel. Wouldn't surprise me if an orc or an ogre jumped out at us. Oops, I think I just saw Shrek." Nighthawk laughed. "I suppose the woods are a little spooky if you're not used to them." He gazed through the windshield, but instead of apprehension, a look of reverence bathed his round, apple-brown features. "It's different when you grow up around here. The forest and the darkness are your friends because they provide protection." He paused and said wistfully, "Most of the time." A few minutes later, Nighthawk brought the truck to a halt and they got out and stood in the cathedral gloom. Clouds of tiny flies whirled around their heads. The powerful scent of pine was almost suffocating, but to Nighthawk it was like the finest perfume. He absorbed the sights and smells with a beatific expression on his face. Then he and Green donned the backpacks that carried cameras and film, survival tools, water, and snacks. Without consulting a compass, Nighthawk started walking. "This way," he said, as confident as if he were following a dotted line on the ground. They moved in silence across the thick carpet made up of decades of fallen pine needles, weaving their way through the tree trunks. The air was hot and oppressive, and sweat soaked their shirts within minutes. Except for clusters of ferns and moss hills, no underbrush grew beneath the trees. They made good time without bushes and briars to slow them down. As he loped after Nighthawk, Green reflected on the path that had led him from the comfort of his air-conditioned office to this murky weald. In addition to his duties with SOS, Green taught part-time at Georgetown University in Washington, which was where he'd met Ben Nighthawk, who was attending his class. The young Indian was in college on scholarship. He wanted to use his education to save the Northwoods environment, which was threatened by development. Struck by Ben's intelligence and enthusiasm, Green had asked him to be a research assistant in the SOS office. The lanky environmentalist and the stocky young Indian were only a few years apart in age, and they'd soon become good friends as well as colleagues. Nighthawk was glad for the friendship because he infrequently made it home. His family lived on the shores of a big lake in a remote and almost inaccessible part of eastern Canada. A seaplane, owned jointly by the villagers, made weekly trips to the nearest town for supplies and emergencies, and also carried mail back and forth. His mother had been keeping Nighthawk up to date about a major construction project on the lake. Someone was probably building a trophy lodge, Nighthawk had assumed with resignation. It was the sort of project he was determined to wage war against when he got out of college. Then the week before, his mother had written an upsetting letter hinting at dark goings-on and asking her son to come home as soon as he could. Green told Nighthawk to take as much time off as he needed. A few days after Nighthawk had left for Canada, he'd called the SOS office. He'd sounded desperate. "I need your help," he implored. "Of course," Green replied, thinking his young friend had run out of money. "How much do you need?" "I don't need any money. I'm worried about my family." Nighthawk explained that he had gone to the town nearest to the village and learned that the seaplane hadn't come in for 2 weeks. The townspeople assumed that the plane had had mechanical problems and that someone would eventually come out of the woods by land looking for replacement parts. He'd borrowed a truck from a relative who lived in town and followed the crude road that led to the village. He'd found the road fenced off and guarded by hard-looking men who said the property was now private. When he'd said he wanted to get to his village, they waved him off with their weapons and warned him not to come back. "I don't understand," Green had said on the phone. "Didn't your family live on reservation land?" "There were only a handful of our people left. A big paper conglomerate owned the land. We were squatters, technically, but the company tolerated us. They even used the tribe in ads to show what nice people they were. They sold the land, and the new owners have been working on a big project on the other side of the lake. It's their land. They can do what they want to." "I know, but that doesn't explain what happened to my people." "Good point. Have you gone to the authorities?" "It was the first thing I did. I talked to the provincial police. They said they were contacted by a city lawyer who told them that the villagers had been evicted."
"But where did they go?"
"The police asked the same question. The lawyer said they moved on. Probably squatting on someone else's property," he said. "You have to understand, my people are considered eccentric anachronisms. The police here say there is nothing they can do. I need help." As they talked, Green checked his calendar. "I'll have the company plane run me up there tomorrow morning," he said. SOS leased an executive jet that was on standby. "Are you sure?"
"Why not?
With Marcus tied up in Denmark, I'm nominally in command. And to be honest, having to deal with all the egos and turf wars in this office is driving me bonkers. Tell me where you are." True to his word, Green had flown into Quebec the following day. He'd caught a connector flight on a small plane that took him to the town Nighthawk had called from. Ben had been waiting at the tiny airport, the truck packed with camping supplies and ready to go. They'd driven several hours along back roads and camped overnight. Looking at the map by the light of the camp lantern, Green had seen that the forest covered a huge area, pockmarked with large bodies of fresh water. Ben's family lived off the land, fished and hunted for a living, and brought in hard cash revenue from the sports fishermen and hunters. Green had suggested hiring a float plane to take them in, but Nighthawk said the heavily armed guards he'd encountered had made it clear that trespassers would be shot. The access road they guarded wasn't the only way to get to the village, Nighthawk said. The next morning, they'd driven a few more hours, never encountering another vehicle until they'd come to the track that led into the deep woods. After leaving the truck, they walked now for about an hour, moving like shadows in the silence of the tall trees, until Nighthawk stopped and raised his hand. He froze in place, eyes half closed, moving his head slightly back and forth like a radar antenna focusing in on an incoming target. He seemed to have forsaken the ordinary senses of sight and hearing and was using some inner direction finder. As Green watched, fascinated, he thought, "You can take the Indian out of the forest, but you can't take the forest out of the Indian." At last, Nighthawk relaxed, reached into his pack and unscrewed a canteen. He handed it to Green. I hate to be a pest, Green said, taking a swig of warm water. But how much farther do we have to walk? Nighthawk pointed toward the line of trees. About 100 yards that way is a hunter's trail that will take us to the lake. How do you know? Ben tapped his nose. No big deal. I've been following the water smell. Try it. After a sniff or two, Green found, to his surprise, that he could pick up the faint scent of rotting vegetation and fish mixed in with the fragrance of pine. Nighthawk took some water and tucked the canteen back into his pack. Lowering his voice, he said, "We'll have to be very careful from here on in. I'll communicate with hand signals." Green gave him the okay sign and they set off again. Almost immediately, the scenery began to change. The trees grew shorter and slimmer as the soil under their feet became sandier. The undergrowth thickened and they had to push their way through thorns that ripped at their clothes. Shafts of light streamed in from breaks in the trees overhead. Then, quite suddenly, they could see the sparkle of water. At a signal from Nighthawk, they got down on their hands and knees and made their way to the edge of the lake. After a moment, Nighthawk stood and walked to the water's edge with Green following. An elderly Cessna floatplane was tied up at a rickety dock. Nighthawk inspected the plane, finding nothing out of place. He removed the cowling and gasped when he saw the engine.
Josh, look at this.
Green peered at the engine.
Looks like someone took an axe to it.
The hoses and connections hung loose where they had been cut. The engine was scarred in a dozen places where it had been hit with something hard. This is why no one could fly out of here, Nighthawk said. He pointed to a foot-worn trail that led away from the floatplane dock. That path leads to the village.
Within minutes, they were making their way to the edge of a clearing. Nighthawk held out his hand for them to stop.
Then he squatted on his haunches and peered with sharp eyes through the bushes.
There's no one here, he said finally.
Are you sure?
Unfortunately, yes, Nighthawk said. He walked unafraid into the open, with Green hesitantly taking up the rear. The village consisted of a dozen or so sturdy-looking log houses, most with porches. They were built on both sides of a swath of packed-down dirt and a rough approximation of a small-town main street, complete with one structure that had a general store sign on it. Green expected someone to burst out the front door at any moment, but the store and every other house in the village were as still as tombs.
This is my house, where my parents and my sister lived, Nighthawk said, stopping in front of one of the larger structures.
He went up on the porch and went inside. After a few minutes, he came out, shaking his head.
No one. Everything is in place, like they just stepped out for a minute.
I poked my head in a couple of the other places, Green said.
Same thing.
How many people lived here?
40 or so.
Where could they have gone?
Nighthawk walked to the edge of the lake a few yards away. He stood, listening to the quiet lap of the waves. After a moment, he pointed to the opposite shore and said,
"Maybe over there?"
Green squinted across the lake.
"How can you be sure?"
"My mother wrote that there was funny stuff going on across the lake. We've got to check it out."
"What kind of funny stuff?"
"She said big helicopters were coming in and unloading material night and day. When the village men went over to investigate, they were run off by guards. Then one day, some guys with guns came over to the village and looked around. They didn't hurt anyone, but my mother figured they'd be back."
"Wouldn't it be better to go tell the authorities? They could send someone in by plane."
"I don't think there's time," Nighthawk said. "Her letter is more than 2 weeks old. Besides, I can feel danger and death in the air."
Green shuddered. He was stuck in the middle of nowhere, and the only person who could get him out was raving like a medicine man in a B-movie.
Sensing his friend's nervousness, Nighthawk smiled and said, "Don't worry, I'm not going native. That's a good suggestion about the cops. I'd feel better if we checked things out first.
Come on, he said, and headed back to the knoll they had climbed a few minutes before. They came to a natural overhang of rock. Nighthawk pulled away some branches that covered the opening. Lying upside down on a crude rack was a birch bark canoe. Nighthawk ran his hand lovingly over the shiny surface.
I made this myself. Used only traditional materials and techniques.
It's beautiful, Green said.
Straight out of Last of the Mohicans.
Better. I've gone all over the lake in it. They dragged the canoe to the beach, dined on beef jerky, and rested as they waited for the sun to go down. With the approach of dusk, they threw their packs into the canoe, pushed it into the water, and started paddling. Night had fallen by the time they drew close to the shore. They had to stop when the canoe hit something solid in the water. Nighthawk reached down, thinking they had hit a rock. It's some kind of metal cage, like a bait box. He scanned the water with his sharp eyes. The water is filled with them. I smell fish. Lots of them. It must be some sort of hatchery operation. They found a breach in the floating barricade and pointed the canoe toward land. Something stirred and splashed in the metal cages, confirming Nighthawk's theory of a fish hatchery. Eventually, they came to the outer end of a floating dock lit by dim, ankle-high lights they had seen from the water. Tied up to a series of finger piers were several jet skis and powerboats. Next to the smaller watercraft was a large catamaran. It had a conveyor belt running down the middle, and Nighthawk guessed it was used in the hatchery operation. I've got an idea, Green said. Working systematically, he pulled the ignition keys from the jet skis and the boats and threw them into the water. Then they tucked the canoe in between the other craft, covered it with a borrowed tarp, and climbed onto the pier. Where the dock joined the shore, it continued as a blacktop walkway that led inland. Nighthawk and Green decided to keep to the woods. After walking a few minutes, they encountered a wide dirt track, as if a big bulldozer had plowed its way through the forest. They followed the swath and came up on a row of trucks and earth-moving machinery, arranged in neat rows behind a huge storage building. Using the shed as a shield, they peered around the corner and saw that they were at the edge of an open area carved out of the woods. It was brightly illuminated by a ring of portable halogen lights. Mechanized shovels flattened down the dirt, and great road-building machines laid down swathes of blacktop. Work crews armed with shovels smoothed out the hot asphalt in preparation for it to be flattened down by the steamrollers.
Nighthawk said, "What do we do next, Professor?"
"How long do we have until daybreak?"
"About 5 hours to first light.
It would be smart to be back on the lake before then." Green sat with his back against a tree. "Let's keep an eye on what's going on until then. I'll take the first watch."
Shortly after midnight, Ben took over. Green stretched out on the ground and closed his eyes. The cleared area was now almost deserted except for a few armed men lounging around.
Nighthawk blinked his eyes and reached over to tap Green's shoulder.
Josh.
Green sat up and looked toward the plaza.
What the hell?
Beyond the clearing, where there were only woods before, was a huge dome-shaped structure whose mottled surface glowed bluish-white. It seemed to have appeared by magic.
What is that thing? Ben whispered. And where did it come from?
You got me, Green said.
Maybe it's a hotel.
Nah, Green said. Too functional looking. Would you stay in a place like that?
I grew up in a log cabin. Any place bigger than that is a hotel.
I don't mean to disparage your home territory, but can you see fishermen and hunters flocking here? That thing belongs in Las Vegas.
We're talking North Pole, man. Looks like an overgrown igloo.
Green had to admit the dome had the same contours as the Eskimo shelters he had seen in National Geographic. But instead of hard snow, the surface appeared to be a translucent plastic material. Huge hangar doors were set into the base of the dome, overlooking the open area which was being built as a plaza. As they watched, there were signs of new activity. The plaza was becoming busy again. The construction crew had returned along with more armed men who could be seen glancing up at the night sky. Before long, the sound of engines could be heard from above. Then a gigantic object moved across the night sky and blotted out the stars. "Look at the dome," Nighthawk said. A vertical seam had appeared in the top of the structure. The seam widened into a wedge, then the top half of the dome peeled back like the sections of an orange until it was completely open. Light streamed out of the dome's interior and bathed the silvery skin of a gigantic torpedo-shaped object that moved slowly to a position exactly above the vast opening. "We were both wrong," Nighthawk said. "Our Las Vegas hotel is a blimp hangar." Green had been studying the contours of the enormous aircraft. "You ever see that old news footage about the Hindenburg? That big German airship that caught fire and burned back in the 1930s? But what's something like that doing here?"
"I think we may find out very soon," Green said. The descending airship sank into the structure and the sections of the dome moved back into place and restored the round shape. Before long, the doors overlooking the plaza slid open and a group of men emerged from inside the structure. They were dressed in black uniforms and all had dark, swarthy complexions. They swarmed around a man whose bullish head was set on powerful shoulders. The man walked over to the edge of the plaza and inspected the progress of the work. Nighthawk had paid little attention to the workers before, but now he could see that, unlike the uniformed men, these people were dressed in jeans and work shirts, and armed guards were watching them.
"Oh, hell," he whispered.
"What's wrong?" Green said.
"Those are men from my village.
That's my brother and father.
But I don't see my mother or any of the other women."
The leader continued on his inspection tour, walking around the edge of the plaza. The men who had been guarding the workers watched their leader's progress. Taking advantage of their inattention, one of the laborers had edged closer to the woods. Then he dropped his shovel and made a break for freedom. Something about the way he ran, with a slight limp, looked familiar to Nighthawk.
"That's my cousin," he said. "I can tell by the way he runs. He hurt his foot bad when we were kids."
One of the guards glanced back and saw the fleeing man. He raised his gun to fire, but lowered it at an apparent command from the bull-headed man. He stepped over to a stack of tools and snatched up a sharp-tipped metal pike from the pile. He held it lightly in two hands, drew back like a javelin thrower, then snapped the pike forward with all the strength of his squat, powerful body. The missile flew through the air in a metallic blur. It had been thrown expertly ahead of the runner in a high, looping trajectory and timed so that it caught him between the shoulder blades. He went down, pinned like a butterfly in a collection book. By then, the leader had turned his back and didn't even see him fall. The whole scene, the aborted escape and the killing of his cousin, had only taken a few seconds. Nighthawk had watched, frozen in place, but now he lunged forward and, despite Green's attempts to hold him back, broke from cover and ran toward his cousin's body. Green scrambled after the young Indian and brought him down in a flying tackle. He was on his feet a second later, pulling Nighthawk to his feet by the scruff of his neck. They were clearly visible in the bright glare of lights. Nighthawk saw the guns pointed in their direction and his instincts took over. He and Green dashed for the woods. Shots rang out, and Green fell. Nighthawk stopped and went to help his companion, but the bullet had caught Green in the back of the head and destroyed his skull. Nighthawk turned and ran, geysers of earth erupting around his feet. He dove into the forest while a fusillade from the plaza shredded the branches over his head. Under a shower of twigs and leaves, he dashed through the trees until he came to the edge of the lake, and his feet pounded onto the dock. He saw the jet skis and wished Green had kept one ignition key. Nighthawk unsheathed a hunting knife from his belt and sliced the mooring lines. Then he shoved the watercraft as far away from the dock as he could. He whipped the tarp from the canoe, pushed off, and began to paddle furiously. He was in open water when he saw muzzle flashes from the dock area and heard the rattle of automatic arms fire. The shooters were firing blind, and their bullets were hitting the water off to one side. The canoe flew across the lake until it was out of range. Nighthawk continued to paddle with all his strength. Once he had gained the other shore, he could lose himself in the deep woods. It is never entirely dark on water, which catches and magnifies even the tiniest speck of light. But now the lake around him began to glow as if it were infused with a luminescent chemical. He turned and saw the light was not coming from the lake, but was a reflection. Behind him, a wide shaft of light was shining toward the heavens. The dome was opening. The airship was rising slowly into the air. When it was a few hundred feet over the trees, the airship headed toward the lake. Bathed in the eerie light from below, the airship looked like an avenging monster out of some time-shrouded myth. Instead of approaching on a straight line, the airship turned sharply and moved along the shore. Beams of light shot out from its underbelly and probed the surface of the lake. After making its first pass, the airship turned onto a parallel track. Rather than make a random thrust into the space over the lake, the airship was conducting a thorough search, using a lawn mowing pattern. Nighthawk was paddling for all he was worth, but it would be only a matter of minutes before the bull's eyes, dancing over the lake's surface, caught the canoe. The airship made another turn and started back on a course that would take it directly over the canoe. Once spotted, the canoe would be an easy target. Nighthawk knew there was only one option available to him. He drew his hunting knife and slashed a hole in the bottom of the canoe. Cold water poured in and surged around his waist. The water was up to his neck as the airship blotted out the sky almost directly overhead. The guttural noise of its engines blocked out all other sound. Nighthawk ducked his head and held onto the sinking canoe to keep it below the surface. Above him, the water glowed white from the moving searchlights, then went black again. He stayed under as long as he could, then, gasping for breath, he popped his head out of the water. The airship had turned for another pass. Nighthawk could hear another sound mingling with the throb of engines, the whine and snarl of jet skis. Someone must have had spare ignition keys. Nighthawk swam off at an angle, away from the village. Minutes later, he saw lights scudding across the lake at great speed as the jet skis made directly for the deserted village. Nighthawk kept swimming until he felt soft muck under his feet. He crawled up onto the shore, exhausted from the swim, but he only rested long enough to wring water out of his shirt. Lights were coming his way along the beach. Nighthawk took one last sorrowful look across the lake before he melted into the woods like a sodden wraith.